Welcome, everybody. This is episode 189 of The Rock Show. I'm Rocker Mike. We've got Rob Rossi, top left. Hello, Rob. And we have special guest, James Chikanjemi. How you doing, James?
I'm all right. How are you guys doing?
Okay. Pretty good. Glad you're here. Just so everybody knows, James and I, we've been friends for many, many years. And we brought him in today to talk about AC/DC's Back in Black album, the making of this amazing record. Little history on James. He played in some great New York City bands over the last 35 years. That would be the Beauty School Dropouts. That would be Skivats. And for a short time, The Orphans. I have to bring them up. Okay. And you're mostly a bassist and sometimes vocalist. And I brought you in today because you're such an AC/DC fan. You know, and me and you go back a long time with music, and AC/DC was definitely one of those bands we first talked about when we met many years ago. So I brought you in as the house expert today.
Excellent.
All right. So a little history on Back in Black. It is the seventh studio album by AC/DC, who are from Australia, in case you forgot. And it came out on Atlantic Records on July 25th, 1980. Right. That's the album cover right there. It was their first album with the new vocalist, Brian Johnson, who had replaced singer Bon Scott, who sadly passed away in February of 1980 of basically alcohol poisoning. He kind of drank himself to death in the back of his Rolls Royce. That's a whole story in itself. But the band, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty after he passed away for a few weeks. They were uncertain if they were going to go on. They were uncertain, you know, what they could do without Bon in the band, you know. So the previous album with Bon Scott was Highway to Hell. That had come out in 1979, the year before. And that had been a breakthrough record for the band, especially in the United States. They had done well, you know, in Europe and UK and Australia, of course. They hadn't really broken too much in the US until that album came out. You agree with that, James?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. So they needed a follow-up, okay, to Highway to Hell. And I think Atlantic Records having Led Zeppelin on their lineup and seeing that Zeppelin was kind of collapsing at that point. They were looking for a new rock band. What do you think? You think that's true?
Absolutely. You know, I think it was Power Age Tour. DC came to the States, probably one of the first times.
Right.
That was about
70, 77, right?
77, 78. They opened up for Aerosmith.
Mm-hmm.
And in between shows, like they would do, let's say they did The Garden with Aerosmith on a Saturday. Sunday, they would do the Palladium by themselves, headline it. Then go back to do an arena tour with, you know, Aerosmith as the opening act.
Right.
So I think Atlantic started seeing them as they could sell records here in America. Atlantic knew Zeppelin was having turmoil, and they looked to AC/DC to be the, you know, their next rock band.
Right. The next Led Zeppelin.
Yes. And yeah. I think at this point, Atlantic you know, got sick of Angus and Malcolm and their George Young. It was basically, that was the DC camp, you know, it was the three of them. And George Young had produced everything up to that point.
George Young, so people know, was Malcolm and Angus's uncle.
Was he uncle or brother?
I always get mixed up with that, but he was related to them.
He was exactly in the Easy Beats.
You're right. He was in the Easy Beats, yeah. Another great band.
So I think, Atlantic wanted to give a try with another producer at this point.
Right. So you mentioned them doing sideshows. One famous thing at that time with Bon and the band was them playing CBGBs.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. It was funny because they did The Garden with Aerosmith, I believe.
Right.
Next night they did the Palladium by themselves. After the Palladium, they went down to CBGB's and did like three or four or five songs there.
I think that was like a surprise show. They just walked in and set up. You know? And I had heard stories that like even at that point, some of the punk bands like the Ramones were listening to AC/DC. So I think there must have been some communication there to have them come down.
Absolutely.
Funny story I heard about that show. And again, this was the Highway to Hell time with Bon still in the band. When they did that, there was like some metalheads that knew that it was going to happen. So they kind of converged on CBGBs, which really wasn't – in those days, metalheads and punks didn't really get along too good. But I knew a girl that actually went to that show.
Awesome.
And she said she like punched some Sid Vicious looking guy in the face.
Joey was at that show.
Yeah, of course. I'm sure he was.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that must have been. I mean, I've seen still pictures of it. And if you remember CB's, how small it was. Bon had Angus on his shoulders walking through the crowd at CB's. Yeah, right. I mean. That's insane. Okay.
That's awesome.
How is he doing that, you know?
Yeah, but, that's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, so, AC/DC after the death of Bon, a little bit of turmoil, but they decided to let's do a follow up. And of course, they would recruit Brian Johnson. Now, Brian Johnson was in a band called Jordy, and Bon Scott was a fan of that band. And one little tidbit I didn't know until a couple of years ago when a book about Bon came out. Was that he had actually told the band, if anything ever happens to me, bring Brian Johnson in, bring this guy in.
Yeah.
And so he was kind of already, ready to be coronated in that role. But AC/DC decided to go through with some auditioning anyway, whatever process, maybe they thought they could find somebody better. But really by March 1st, which was only a month after Bon had passed, Brian got a call from Malcolm and said, hey, you're in. So that was basically how Brian got into the band. Now,
I think that the sound with his voice, the sound didn't change. It was still AC/DC. Even with Bon or him, it was like, whoa. You couldn't even tell. Like, it took me a little while to tell the difference. I knew the guy's dead, but I was like, wow, it was good. He just had that voice. He fit in the role. He came in there and knocked them out. And he was a good songwriter, too.
Now, it's funny. I'm remembering a story, Chi, that you told me many, many, many years ago.
All right.
About, I don't know if, maybe you'll even remember it, hopefully. But for some reason, this story always stuck with me. You were a big fan of AC/DC with Bon, okay?
Yes.
You were a kid, and I was a big fan, too. I had that album and... Dirty Deeds with import and stuff like that. But didn't something happen with you with you were playing Highway to Hell and Back in Black was doing really well and somebody said to you, play some AC/DC?
Yes, I do remember that. I forget where it was or what the context of it was. But yeah, I remember that. That's funny.
Yeah. I mean, because I think...
That Back in Black album, it was, at this point I'm living in Long Island and it's like, we were burnouts and long hair and you had, back then you had jocks, you had preppies, you had your different kinds of cliques. So we were burnouts and listening to DC. And it's like all of a sudden when Back in Black started to hit, everybody's listening to AC/DC now.
Right.
So it was probably, one of these people, saying that, well, put on some AC/DC. if you're gonna play rock and roll.
They, they didn't even know that Highway to Hell was AC/DC.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I mean, it goes back to, I think this album, you know, has lasted the test of time, because it's really resonated with people that wouldn't normally have listened to AC/DC, or really just only got turned on to them at that point. But, you know, it sold 25 million records already, if not more now, I think. So it's up there with the biggest albums of all time, absolutely. You know? And I think it's lasted this long in popularity because people that aren't even into metal. I mean, I don't even like really calling it metal, you know, sure. It's lumped in with that, but it's really just a great rock and roll record the way it's supposed to be played.
It is a rock and roll album. Yeah. I agree with that. It's a rock and roll album. And you know what's the funny thing? This album still once in a while sneak into the Billboard 200, especially when they use it like in a movie or TV show. People are like, oh, what's that about? And they'll go out and buy the album. It's crazy.
Yeah, AC/DC is one of these bands that, and there aren't too many like this, that like if they have a new album that comes out, like their back catalog starts to sell again. They I don't know if they space their albums so far apart now that like it's just kind of like, all right, I got to get into the older shit. You know, they get a new generation every time.
You know, it's insane. I saw them live in Fly on the Wall tour. Uh-huh. Then I went to the Who Made Who tour.
Yeah.
And then I didn't go again for 20 years, and I saw them Stiff Upper Lip tour, and it's like
I saw them with you on that tour.
A Stiff Upper Lip, right?
At the Garden.
I believe so.
I went twice on that tour. I think once was with you.
Yeah. I remember going to Mug's Ale House with you after or before the show.
Yes.
I remember one of them hanging out there.
Yeah. Mug's Ale House. Wow. Brooklyn, man. Jeez.
See, now that Stiff Upper Lip tour, they opened up the show with You Shook Me All Night Long.
Yes, yes.
Right there, you knew you're going to have a great show. They're opening up with the best single, you know?
And I'll never forget, they were selling, that was the year 2000. They were selling these like light up horns that you could put on your head. Yes. red horns to go on your head like that. It was like a band that you could just put over your head.
I bought
that. I walked around all day with that shit.
Mike, I told you, I saw them in 98. I'm walking
98.
In 88. 88.
Yeah, I don't think they toured in 98. Yeah.
In 88, and they were doing it was like in August, and I saw SummerSlam and the week before, and then I'm walking around and some guy come up to me. Hey, you want some tickets? And me and Hector, and he gave us tickets for ACD, and I was like, "Oh my god, let's go!" And I bought like a $5 shirt.
Yeah,
we went to the Garden. We were in there for 3 hours. It was a great show.
Now great that
show.
$5 shirt lasted how long? One wash.
So crazy. You know what's the funny thing about that show? The women that would just take and lift their shirts.
It was a different era back then, you know?
Yes. It was crazy. They'll be praying, it's okay.
Yep.
There was nothing like rock and roll shows back in the 80s, early 90s.
Yep, yep. So, all right. So when they were getting ready to record Back in Black, they set up 3 weeks of rehearsals at London's Easy Hire Studios. But their rehearsals would get cut back to 1 week there when an opening in the Bahamas happened. Compass Point Studios in Nassau became available. Obviously you'd get a nice vacation for a couple weeks recording the record, but also for tax purposes. So it really worked out for the band to record there. They did set up recordings between mid-April and May of 1980 down in the Bahamas. Producer Mutt Lang was brought in. He had done Highway to Hell, the prior album. And tell us a little about Mutt Lang. I know you know a little bit, James.
You know, Mutt Lang, originally Atlantic wanted Eddie Kramer to produce Highway to Hell. Mm. So, which like, I thought that would have been great, but Malcolm couldn't stand them. I remember they went down to Miami, they practiced, they did like 6 weeks worth of rehearsals. And Malcolm said, we have no songs with this guy. Called up the manager, told him, we got to get rid of this guy. So they wound up bringing Mutt Lang for Highway to Hell, you know, and to me, Mutt Lang at that point, you know, he's been a producer, but he had nothing was a big smash hit that he's done. You know, he did.
He's a little bit unknown.
Yeah, Boomtown Rats was probably the biggest thing.
Yeah, one or two other things. Yeah.
So, you know, so AC/DC with Mutt Lange, it was kind of a perfect storm to me going into record Back in Black. You know, Mutt Lange had a lot to prove, put his name on the map. DC at this point, like I said, you know, Zeppelin was Atlantic's biggest act
right
to this point, and Zeppelin was folding. You know, Robert Plant was getting into car accidents, canceling tours. So
Page was worshiping Satan.
Page was worshiping Satan. So Atlantic was putting everything into, I think, the Back in Black album with hopes that DC would be, you know, their next Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And, you know, new singer, there was a lot riding on it. So I think, yeah, it was, you know, I think it's a perfect Stormy album. I think that's why it's the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's like everything, the stars lined up perfectly, you know, for making this record.
Exactly. Now,
originally, when they were getting ready to record at Compass Point Studios, this was a place that they never really had to deal with before. Okay. And it was kind of in a little bit of a sketchy neighborhood in Nassau where there was a lot of robberies, and sometimes the studio would get robbed in the middle of the night. So when AC/DC was recording mostly at night, they would block the doors. They would have like spears for fishing, big spears behind the door in case anybody broke in to rob them. You know, it was one of those places. You know, it's funny because it reminds me of, I guess about a year later when the Clash went to Jamaica to make Sandinista, they were like practically getting robbed and shit too. Sure. You know, it was like, who are these white guys here recording this shit? So, they were, you know, they were just, you know, they had this kind of in the back of their mind, they had to be watch their safety there. Also, when they arrived in the Bahamas, there were some hurricanes and tropical storms that kicked in. And, but Brian Johnson, you know, obviously when the hurricanes happened, they lost electric and couldn't do anything, but he would use this as, an influence on some of the lyrics. For instance, the opening lines of Hell's Bells, first song on the album, he says, "I'm rolling thunder, pouring rain. I'm coming on like a hurricane." I mean, that's
words that changed my life, man. You know,
yeah.
Like putting that needle, putting a needle onto that record, the fucking bell going, you know, you're a kid. You're like, this is fucking evil. You know what I mean? And then that guitar kicks in and those lyrics, you know, that solidified me wanting to be a musician that basically, and any form of music I liked beside rock and roll to that point was out the window. And I was just became a rock purist from that line itself. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's, to me, it's one of the greatest opening tracks on any album ever.
It really is.
It sets the pace for the other nine songs. And it just, I don't know. I can listen to that all day. Hell's Bells is like an amazing,
insane,
you know? So, one other problem that they had, in recording is that some of their equipment was held up by customs. Not sure why. Okay. Maybe something they were worried about something being smuggled in. Who knows? Okay. Oh, I can only guess. But what was happening was while they were, you know, delayed getting their equipment, they ended up having to like rush other equipment into the country and just so they could record. So, also Brian Johnson being the new guy in the band, I think he felt a lot of pressure. Him and Mutt Lange, you know, Mutt was very much a perfectionist, and he demanded a lot on Brian Johnson, and he wasn't really used to that kind of producing. Okay. And I guess in Geordie, things were a little looser, but Mutt Lange really kind of wanted to micromanage Brian Johnson's vocals. And I think I'm not saying they weren't getting along or anything like that. It's just like, he really wanted to control everything that Brian did vocally down to when he took a breath. Okay. And I think it paid off because I think this is Brian's greatest vocal achievement.
Wow.
You know, I mean, nothing wrong with any of the records after, but I just think it really, like, you know, it was perfect.
I agree.
It's perfect.
You know, that album, You know, not it's redundant to say it, but everything was perfect on that. You know, everything was, to me, like, I'm the big fan of the drumming on that. Phil Rudd.
Yeah. He doesn't get a lot of respect.
No, no. I mean, listen, he's not a flashy drummer.
He wasn't, but he was perfect. But
there's so much fucking swagger on that album with those drums. Mm-hmm. And they say Mutt Lange, what Mutt Lange did was mic the drums to a PA. Then he recorded the drums from the PA and then overdubbed them with the regular drums together to get such a big sound. And I mean, whatever he did with it, that drum sound, here it is 40 something years later. Mm-hmm. And you can't, nobody, that sound is unparalleled. One of the best drum sounds ever.
Now that would be, I think, a little bit different process than he had even done with Highway to Hell or they had done prior to that, because Bon Scott was a drummer.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So how would they would record with him on drums, at least maybe with demos and stuff like that. Exactly. Right? Okay. And
Angus and Malcolm, it's their band. They run the show. So they'd get together, do riffs, and then the next in line was Bon. They were good friends with Bon. So they'd call him. They'd all go to rehearsal studio. Bon would play drums as Angus and Malcolm bounce riffs and songs off each other.
Exactly.
They say they did that with him with Highway to Hell. I mean, with Back in Black.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know? But obviously, Bon's not there. So now you have Phil Rudd doing all the drumming. It was a little bit different, you know? Exactly. So now, the general attitude of the band at this time was very optimistic. They liked Brian. Okay, they felt that we're going to go somewhere. And, they had a lot of fun making the record. There's one case where they were, one of the songs, I don't know which one it was, but an actual little crab ran across the studio floor as they were recording. Okay. I'm sure they had a kick out of that. Okay. Also, the unique guitar sound, and you're more of a musician than I've ever been, so you probably understand this, James, but the guitar sound that Angus had achieved was from a Schaefer Vega diversity system.
I'm not at all.
Okay, it's a wireless guitar device that gives like a boost to the actual signal. I'm not sure how that works exactly, but I think the guitar sound on that record is unique also.
Oh, it's incredible.
You know, I mean, not just incredible. I think it's unique to that album.
You know, it's funny, like DC, I didn't realize this till I got older. You listen to the early DC stuff. You know, a lot of it is progression of what became Back in Black. But a lot, they were so, so heavily influenced by like Sweet, Mata Hoople, Slade.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of that on the early stuff. And that's the stuff like Atlantic hated, I think. I think Atlantic didn't like that sound. They liked their rocker, you know.
Heavier sound. Yeah.
So it was just such a huge progression. If you're a DC fan, you hear it from album to album to album.
Yeah.
And like, Power Age, is the guitars were getting rawer. Mm-hmm. And then by Back in Black, it's just solidified. It's fucking insane. Yeah.
Well, you know, after that, they never changed after that.
Exactly. After that, everything, they sort of found their formula.
Exactly. You don't see really the evolution that you're talking about between the first six records and then Back in Black.
Exactly.
Everything pretty much is, once they did Back in Black, that was the model.
Exactly. Once you have a top 40 record, you have a top 40 single.
Yeah.
They're sticking with what works. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely.
They had a lot of this album had a lot of good singles. There wasn't a bad song in the whole album.
I'm gonna talk about some of these songs now a little bit more, emphasis on individually. Yeah. Now, Hell's Bells was the first track, like I said before, on the record, and the band needed to record the famous Bells sound. Okay, how do you do that? Okay, so originally they tried to record church bells in England, but what would happen is they would end up getting the sounds of birds on there. as the bell would toll, like you'd hear like flapping of wings. Okay, so that didn't work. Okay, so then they went to a place called the John Taylor Bell Foundry in Leicester. Like, I can never pronounce these British names, Leicester, in England, okay? and they recorded the tolling of a 2,000-pound bronze bell that was located there.
Wow.
Okay. And they used Ronnie Lane's mobile studio, okay, for the process. Now, I like that. Ronnie Lane's mobile studio popped up so many times in our shows when we would talk about in the 70s, like, you know, the Stones were just, it was Ronnie Lane from the Small Faces. He had this, like, mobile studio that he would rent out to the bands, okay? Sure. And they, whatever you had to go somewhere, he was like his, and it just showed up on so many different records that we talked about.
Did they use that for It's Alive?
No.
They didn't? Okay.
No. That was just recorded at the Roundhouse.
Off the soundboard or something. Okay.
Yeah, I think off the soundboard. So now they used, like I said, Ronnie Lane's mobile studio for the process. And then later they mixed it all at Electric Lady Studios in New York City when the album got the final mix there. So even though they recorded this whole album in the Bahamas, it got finally mixed in New York City.
Sure.
Right. I mean, Electric Lady was one of the best. So another track, Shoot to Thrill. What Do You Do for Money, Honey? Giving the Dog a Bone. Okay. And Let Me Put My Love in You. One of my. Okay. That kind of rounds out side one. Let Me Put My Love in You. My mother's eyeballs were like this fucking big when she heard me.
That's the thing. That was one of the best things about AC/DC was it was one of the first rock bands that parents fucking hated. You know what I mean? A parent can sing Stairway to Heaven, but you Let Me Put My Love into You. I don't think anybody's mother's going to be listening.
A little bit different. Yeah. A little bit different. I mean, it's also, you know, they didn't really have it much with this record, but obviously Highway to Hell had a little bit of the, you know, a little satanic imagery. Well, a little bit.
Well, listen, AC/DC has always been evil. You know what I mean? Yeah. They were guys who weren't American trying to sing about what Americans, they thought Americans wanted to hear.
Right, right. And it was had kind of a twist on it, especially the Bon Scott stuff.
You know, the best thing is I bought a 45. Like, you know, I remember watching Casey Kasem as a kid. And when DC was coming up, you know, with Back in Black, they would play the Back in Black video all the time.
Yeah.
So I went out, I got the 45. I still fucking remember it was like red coloring Atlantic label on it. And, you know, I was listening to that constantly, Back in Black. And finally, I flipped it over. You know, I'm young, so I didn't know what a flip side was.
Yeah.
And the fucking flip side is Have a Drink on Me.
Right.
You know, so here's your hit single that you're putting out where the flip side song is equally as good as the, you know, it's insane. It's an insane record.
Yeah, it really is. There's not one bad song, and every song could be an A side or a B side. Doesn't matter.
Exactly.
You know, so the title track, Back in Black, okay, opens up side two. And, you know, that guitar riff is really the hook for the whole song.
Oh, sure.
Okay. And it's, you know, totally classic. And it was written as a tribute to Bon Scott. Okay. In fact, a lot of lyrical references and stuff on here kind of bring back Bon Scott a little bit.
Sure.
And like you say, it was released as a single. It got to number 37. It had Have a Drink on Me as the flip side. It got to number 37 on Billboard charts.
All right.
In the States. So it was a top 40 hit, the track.
Sure.
Now, the next song is the most famous off the album, You Shook Me All Night Long.
Okay. Yep.
And, you know, it's one of these songs that has been played to fucking death.
Yes.
Okay? But I'll be honest with you, I never turn it off when I hear it.
No.
You know, sometimes you hear a song like, shit, I've heard this a million times. I'm changing the station or whatever. Yeah. Not You Shook Me All Night Long. I'll be like, all right, this is for the millionth and one time, but it's great every time.
It's Kiss's Rock and Roll All Night. It's the Ramones Sedated.
Yeah.
You know, you hear these songs on the radio constantly, but it's like it comes on. It's like, yeah, fuck it. It's still a great song. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm not turning it off.
Yeah. Now, Rob, you remember the video for this?
Oh, man.
Remember, it's like part in black and white. And Brian Johnson's walking with a bag of fish and chips. He gets a bag in newspaper.
That video was 6 years after the song came out.
That's right. The video came out a few years after the actual album.
Yeah, that video came out for a best of album.
Right.
And like what Rob was saying earlier, Back in Black charted again. Once that video, 6 years after the record came out, they put out that video.
And all of a sudden,
what's that?
During Who Made Who?
During Who Made Who. And all of a sudden, you know, Who Made Who record is selling and Back in Black is selling again.
Yeah. That's what happens anytime these guys go do a, like, look at right now how strange it is that the Beatles took out a new song because they finally got able to separate with that guy. What was it? Peter Jackson, that director? He did that documentary about Get Back.
Let It Be. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. But I'm gonna just drop a little bomb. We don't have to get into this too much, but that new Beatles song sucks.
I haven't listened to it yet.
Okay. I heard it. I heard it on like 2 days ago. Like it was out maybe for a day, and I heard it, and I'm like, this is like the weakest fucking Beatles song I've ever heard. Right. And but then again, I said to myself, I'm like, what year is this? Because the Stones got a new record out and so did the Beatles. I'm like, what?
I'm a Stones guy. So
but I'm a Stones guy, too.
Yeah.
But I do love my Beatles. Okay?
Yeah, of course.
You know, and I'm like, this would have been better off left in the fucking closet, this song. You know what I mean? It's just, I don't know. It didn't move me at all.
Well, we live in a world that nothing's sacred anymore, you know? No, so true.
Yeah. I just shit on the Beatles. Sorry. Okay. Anyway, so the one thing now about this entire album is that there's always been discussion as to how much Bon Scott was involved with it before he died. Okay. Now, two books. One was called Bon, the Last Highway, and AC/DC, Hell Ain't a Bad Place to Be. Both cite individuals close to Bon Scott saying that they saw lyrics in his lyric book. He was known to carry a lyric book around, okay, as far back as 1976 for the track You Shook Me All Night Long.
Whoa.
Okay. The band itself has never admitted this, okay, that they used any of Bon's lyrics. But I kind of, you know, the book I read was The Last Highway. Okay. And it kind of convinced me that at least that song, he had written some of the lyrics. It has a kind of Bon Scott feel to it. You know, like the line, she told me to come, but I was already there.
Absolutely.
That's a Bon Scott lyric. That's got to be.
I'm already there.
Exactly. Rock and roll ain't noise pollution. A lot of that sounds like Bon. I'm a personal.
Actually, that's not all right.
I know.
I'll tell you why. That song was they were influenced by what was happening at the Marquee in London.
Sure.
The Marquee in London at the time was, well, it still is. It's in the middle of a residential area, and they would always have problems with, you know, neighbors complaining about the volume at the club. Okay, so they were. This song was written at a time when they were hearing that this was happening all the time. So sure. That was the influence to that.
Yeah.
But Now
my belief is.
Yeah.
You know, I think
giving the dog a bone, right?
Well, what they were saying, see, to me, yeah, because like Bon was more secretive. You know, he was. Double meanings with his lyrics.
Right, double entendres.
Yeah, whereas Johnson's more in your face.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of it, if it was being done, I think it was Angus and Malcolm throwing out words. You know, because from what I have read and heard is a lot of Back in Black, a lot of people gave input to the lyrics. In fact, Mutt Lange after Back in Black was the last album where every album after that, he wants a lyric credit on.
Oh.
And so a lot of people say he would throw out certain lines.
And he figured because Back in Black was so successful, he should get
credit. He wants, you know, if I give you a lyric, a line, I want a credit now.
That makes sense.
I think a lot of it was like Johnson did a lot. And then I think if anything was Bond influence, would be Malcolm Angus coming up with lines. You know, that might have been written by Bond. You know
and maybe they were consciously trying to write like Bond.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, maybe they were like, how would Bond write that? You know,
listen, Malcolm and Angus were fucking rootless too. You know, I love the guys and I love their playing, I love the music, but they were fucking businessmen.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, like the whole thing they did with Johnson by getting Axl Rose in when Johnson, they just should have canceled that tour.
Yeah.
You know, Angus is a businessman. So, you know, does he have morals? I'm sure, but to what degree? You know, that's the...
The fact that George Young was with them when they were just starting out, he was probably giving them some business because...
Absolutely,
business
life, yeah. You know?
Absolutely.
You know, so, you know what the funny thing when you guys are talking about that, you know, think about it. Bond and Malcolm and Yang, those guys were always together. So they could easily, like, who wrote what? They could easily be throwing words around and stuff like that by the end.
Exactly.
You don't know who wrote what. It's like, all exactly. Right, oh, this sounds good. That's right there.
I mean, they were together for 6 years, okay? Yes. Tight, okay? Struggling, you know, doing some amazing original rock and roll. And obviously they're going to be influenced by each other. It's a good point, Rob.
You know, when George Young came back to producing them, after Back in Black, I guess Mutt Lang did For Those About to Rock.
Yeah.
AC/DC produced two themselves.
Was it Flick of the Switch?
Flick of the Switch and Fly on the Wall.
Fly on the Wall, man.
Yeah. Horrible production, horrible engineering, but still decent song.
I'll never forget at the Ritz. That was like 1986 that album came out, okay? The Ramones on stage, Joey's wearing an AC/DC Fly on a Wall shirt.
Nice.
Okay? And it was, you know, the whole, it was like the coolest, I don't think I've ever seen this shirt anywhere else. It just was like with the fly and it was in pink. And
oh, it's all, yeah, awesome.
I mean, I was like, that is the coolest fucking shirt ever. He was always a big promoter of the
band. See, now, after that album, I believe it's either that album or the next album, they told Brian Johnson they don't want to write the lyrics anymore. And ever since then, the lyrics, all songs written by Young and Young. And Johnson hasn't wrote a lyric since early 90s. Yeah. Yeah. And see, that's where I go back to saying how ruthless they are. You know, they brought George Young back producing them. And all of a sudden, they said Brian was going through a bad divorce and didn't have time to write lyrics. But he's never written a lyric on a DC album again after maybe it's Blow Up Your Video was the last album.
Blow Up Your Video is the one with Heatseeker on it.
Yeah, after that, it's either that album or the one after it, stopped writing lyrics.
That's the tour you saw them on, Rob, in 88.
Yes.
Yeah.
It had to be Blow Up Your Video. Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, that's what
it was. I didn't know he wasn't writing lyrics anymore.
Yeah, you know, I guess here, now they don't have to pay an extra songwriting credit. The Young brothers, the Young family is a very business family, you know?
Well, look, he's getting his share, you know?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So the next couple of tracks, Have a Drink on Me and Shake a Leg, okay? They were followed by the final single released on Back in Black, which is Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution. That single got to number 15 in the UK. The highest of any single on that album, believe it or not. Okay. And, but it almost didn't make the album. AC/DC was planning on releasing only 9 songs on Back in Black. Wow. And Atlantic said, no, put one more on there. So, you know, they had quickly to come up with something. And like I described earlier, it was the situation, what was going on at the Marquee in London. Was the influence for making Rock and Roll Ain't Noise Pollution. That was actually written in the studio, you know. So Back in Black was released in the U.S. on July 25th, 1980, and other countries would follow over the next pretty much 2 weeks. It would come out everywhere. And it was a commercial success in England immediately. It debuted at number 1 in the U.K. It got to number 4 in America. And it got to number 1 in England for 2 weeks and stayed in the top 10 in America for 5 months.
Unbelievable. You know,
and actually, even though it got higher in England, it stayed less in the charts. Okay. But in America, it lingered there. I remember that. I remember that being like you couldn't get rid of that album. It was constantly.
It's like I remember every car that passed you was playing a song off it. Everywhere you went, that album was being played.
Right, right.
That's an insane album.
Yeah, yeah. Now, after the release of the album, previous albums, Highway to Hell, If You Want Blood, You Got It, and Let There Be Rock, all re-entered the British charts.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And that would be, that would happen to them throughout their career. If they came out with a new album, the old shit would start to sell again.
Well, I mean, listen, as a kid, Back in Black is probably the first album I bought.
Right. Yeah.
And as soon as I had that album, all I did was get the back catalog. You know, that was one of the first things I did, is I bought every AC/DC album up to that point.
Yeah.
Well, probably from 1980 to 81, 82. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, the first album I remember buying was Kiss Alive.
Mine was Love Done.
and then I bought, I was a big Doors fan. Okay. So I think I bought a Greatest Hits. And then I remember buying, this is like in the late 70s. I remember buying Parallel Lines from Blondie.
Nice.
And then I remember buying a Cars record, I think second album, I think. And then, you know, 80, Back in Black comes out. And I had Highway to Hell also. Okay. Sure. 79, I bought that. And then I had bought the import of Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap with the different album cover with the big muscle on like that. I remember saving my fucking allowance for like a month to buy this freaking thing. Okay. And what happened? Fucking Atlantic released it in America like as soon as Back in Black came out. So I rebought it because it had a different album cover, you know.
See, now me, when Back in Black came out and I went and I was rebuying the old ones, everything I got was Cut Corner.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's funny because they were all selling $3.99, $2.99.
Yeah.
To think about AC/DC being Cut Corner.
I know.
It's insane.
I remember the cut corner racket, Corvettes.
You had to do it on the right side, on the left side, you know. Yeah,
exactly. And actually, with all these albums in the UK coming back in the charts, they were the first band since the Beatles to have four different albums in the charts at the same time.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
You know which albums?
It was basically, it was Highway to Hell. If you want blood, you got it. Let There Be Rock.
Oh, really?
Okay, and obviously Back in Black. So it was those four, you know.
Sure.
So the success of Back in Black made Atlantic release the import of Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, like I just said. Now, that album was recorded in 76 and never released in the States. I don't know why Atlantic didn't want to release this record when they released High Voltage.
Sure.
Okay. I don't know why they held that back. There's nothing wrong with that record, you know.
You know, I need to go back and buy. I stopped buying DC. I stopped listening, like being probably after Fly on the Wall. I haven't bought a record from them. You know,
the last one I bought was Stiff Upper Lip.
Okay, yeah, I didn't even buy that. I went on tour to see them there, but it's like I need to go and buy their later stuff. I guess it's 30 years old now, but to me, it's later stuff.
After Stiff Upper Lip, they didn't put nothing out for 10 years.
No, then it was that Black Ice, right?
Black Ice. I think it might have even been longer than 10 years.
Sure.
And Black Ice is a good record. I never really gave it a big serious listen, but it's an okay album.
Sure. For those about to rock, I still love, even though people said it was a bad follow-up. I thought it was a great follow-up.
No, there was nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, you know, how many bands bring a fucking cannon on stage?
It's funny. After the success of Back in Black, that's when Mutt Lange got the reputation of taking 8 years to do a record.
Right.
You know, every band he worked with, it'd be 4 years, 2 years, 3 years. They'd be working on records forever, and he became a perfectionist.
Wow. Where is he these days?
You know, he went on, he produced Def Leppard. He did Foreigner. Did all the Bryan Adams albums.
That's right. That's
then
right.
Then he married Shania Twain, I think it was.
Really?
Yeah, and produced her stuff. Shania Twain, I forget who it was. He married some woman singer. Mm. Shania Twain, or I know he produced her, maybe Celine Dion. One of those he married.
Well, Celine Dion was married. He wasn't married to her. He was. If he produced her, I don't know. But
maybe he produced it. So maybe
she was married to that old fossil.
Let me see who the hell he married. I think it was Shania Twain. He was married to.
Maybe.
Which is weird. Wasn't she country or no?
Pop country. You know.
Yeah. Shania Twain. He married.
Yeah. Maybe.
Yeah.
Well, An interesting little tidbit that kind of gets lost in the shuffle here is that when they Atlantic decided to release AC/DC's Dirty Deeds album, which was recorded in 76 and never released in the States, they released it after Back in Black had gotten to number four.
Exactly.
Guess where Dirty Deeds got to?
What did it get to?
Three.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, holy shit, how'd that happen?
Okay. See, now Dirty Deeds still has some of that early influence, like the Slade, yeah. I mean, you know, type of stuff.
That had Problem Child on it. I'm a Rock.
Yeah, great stuff.
Yeah, and of course the title track, which I mean that in the I can remember them doing constant, like when Dirty Deeds got released, they would do constant double shots of the title track, Back in Black, and Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap on the radio.
Yes.
That was fantastic. So now recent numbers put that they've sold 25 million records.
Yeah.
All right. That's just US, right?
That's just the US. Okay. Then you got it. It's like twice that in the UK.
Yeah, I think it's 44 million altogether. Like some shit like that.
Yeah, so you know you're talking an insane. I mean, they'll be making money off that for the rest of their lives. They didn't have to make it on the record, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right, so that's the show on Back in Black. James, I want to thank you for coming on, man. You definitely brought some good shit here.
Thank you, guys. You prevented me from doing yard work. Anytime I can do that.
That's cool. So, all right. Rob, where can we find you?
You can find me on, you know, any social platform, Facebook, Instagram, X, and the Getting Lumped Up website. So if you ever want to drop me a line, you can drop me a line and any of those. Also, the Rocker Rob and Mike Facebook page, which gets a lot of people on there.
Yeah, the Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi Facebook Rock Show group page, I should say. Okay, we got like about, what, almost 2,000 members now, I think.
Nice. Yeah, we got a lot.
It's pretty good. And I do like a song of the day, and I post different shit, and, you know, we keep it cool. So if anybody's looking for me, I'm all over the place. Instagram, RockerMike212, X, formerly Twitter, RockerMike212. If you want me on Facebook, though, I'm Rocko Mike, because Zuckerberg's an asshole and won't let me be Rocko. Okay. I'm showing my 50% Sicilian side on that fucking thing. So Rocko Mike, and of course the Rock Show Podcast group page on Facebook, and then there's Rocker Mike. You could find me as Rocker Mike on like MeWe, Clout Hub, Truth Social, Getter, all that. Do my song of the day, lumped up song of the night. Contact me anyway. All right. And James, do you have any? You know, are you doing anything musically?
No.
Besides yard work?
Just yard work, yo. That's about it.
All right. Well, listen, you know, one thing, you played in the Beauty School Dropouts, and they were one of the greatest live bands I've ever seen. All right.
Thank you.
And I was there kind of at the beginning, and, you know, it was just an honor to be there. And you guys did a lot of great shows over the years. Occasionally, if you do a reunion, I know you do one every so often.
Every so often.
You know, you did the Johnny Thunders thing back in July. You know, yeah, always let me know. I'll put the word out.
All right. Excellent, man. Thank you guys for having me today.
Yeah. Appreciate it. All right. So we'll talk soon. All right.
All right. Cool, man.
All right.
And remember, don't get drunk.
Get lumped up.
We'll see you next week.
Take care, people.